Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the best podcast ever. You can support the Hemingway List at patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. We're talking about part two, chapter 11. Shmoop.com says, a young girl's imperial dominion. The narrator tells us that if Julian were more observant, he'd realize just how crushing Matilda can be to anyone who annoys her. She receives a lot of love letters from young men and is basically a heartbreaker. One day, Matilda realizes that she's totally in love with Julian. She's never known the feeling before, and it feels great. Very cool. No discussion on this chapter. Well, I just realized that as I refreshed the Reddit page. Interesting, no one had anything to say about that chapter. I suppose that happens now and then. That's okay. Let's just have a short one then, hey? Let's have a short one. And read chapter 12. Just go straight into it. because why not? Chapter 12 is called Will He Be a Danton? The need for nervous excitement that is what characterized the beautiful Marguerite de Valois, my aunt, who soon married the King of Navarre, the one who we now see reigning in France, bearing the name of Henry IV. The whole secret of the princess's delightful character lay in her need to take risks. From this derived, from the age of 16 onwards, her quarrels and reconciliations with her brothers. Now, what can a young woman take risks with? With the most precious thing she has, her honour, her reputation for the rest of her life. Memories of the Duc d'Angoulême, natural son of Charles IX. Quite a long pretext. Okay, here we go. Between myself and Julian, there is no signing of contracts, no lawyer. All is heroic. All will be the fruit of chance. Save for noble birth, which he lacks, it is the love of Marguerite de Valois for the young La Mole, the most remarkable man of his time. Is it my fault that the young men of court are such slaves to the conventional and turn pale at the very idea of any adventure that is the least bit exotic? For them, a little tour around Greece or to Africa is the height of audacity. And even then, they wouldn't know how to proceed except in a group. From the moment they find themselves alone, they are terrified, not of the lance of the Bedouin, but of ridicule, and that fear drives them to distraction. By contrast, my dear little Julian cares only to act on his own, never for this exalted being the slightest notion of looking for support and help from others. He despises others, and because of that I do not despise him. If, being poor, Julian was nobly born, my love would be nothing more than a common stupidity, a banal misalliance. I wouldn't want it. It would lack the hallmarks of a grand passion, the vastness of the difficulties to be overcome, and the dark uncertainty of events. Mademoiselle de La Mole was so preoccupied with these fine sentiments that the following day, without thinking of it, she boasted about Julian to the Marquise de Crisnoy and her brother. Her eloquence went so far that it riled them. Be on your guard against that young man. He has far too much energy, cried her brother. If the revolution were to begin again, he would have all of us guillotined. She refrained from a direct retort and hurriedly set to teasing her brother and the Marquise de Crisnoy about the fear that energy produced in them. At bottom, it was no more than the fear of encountering the unexpected, simply the terror of being taken aback by the unexpected. Always, gentlemen, always the fear of ridicule, the monster that unhappily died in 1816. Monsieur de La Mole used to say that in a country that has two parties, ridicule can no longer exist. His daughter had understood this idea, so, you see, gentlemen, she said to Julian's opponents, you will have been scared stiff all your lives, and afterwards you will be told, it wasn't a wolf, it was nothing but its ghost. Shortly after that Matilda left them, her brother's remark had filled her with horror. It worried her deeply. However, by the next day she divined in it a most delectable form of praise. In this century, when all energy is dead, Julian's energy frightens them. I will tell him what my brother said. I would like to see the response he makes. But I will choose one of those occasions when his eyes are shining. Then he won't be able to lie to me. He will be a Danton, she said to herself after a long and rambling reverie. Very well, the revolution will begin anew. What part will Cresnoy and my brother play then? It is written out for them in advance, sublime resignation. They will be heroic sheep, allowing their throats to be cut without saying a word. In dying, their sole worry will still be about whether it is in bad taste. But if he had the slightest hope of getting away, my little Julian would blow out the brains of any Jacobin who tried to arrest him. He is not frightened of being in bad taste, not he. These last words made her thoughtful. They reawakened painful memories and took away all her confidence. They reminded her of jokes made by Montures de Calus de Cresnoy de Luz and her brother. These gentlemen had unanimously picked on Julian's priestly air, humble and hypocritical. Ah, but, she added suddenly, her eyes sparkling with joy, the sheer amount of such jibes and their bitterness proves that, in spite of them, he is the most distinguished man we have seen this winter. What do his faults signify? His absurdities. He has greatness, and they, otherwise, so kind and indulgent, are shocked by it. He well knows that he's poor and must study to be a priest. They are army officers and do not need to study. It's so much easier. Also, in spite of all the handicaps imposed on him by his perpetual black coat and that priestly look, which he's obliged to assume, poor boy, under pain of starving to death, his talents frighten them. Nothing could be more obvious, and the priestly physiognomy, it's no longer noticeable. The moment we're alone together for a few minutes, again, whenever these gentlemen say something they think is subtle or original, isn't their first glance always at Julian? I've noticed that most definitely. Moreover, they know very well that he never addresses a word to them without being asked. It's only with me that he starts a conversation. He thinks I have an elevated soul. He replies to their objections only insofar as politeness requires. He goes back to the deferential pose directly. With me, he will argue for hours on end. He isn't sure about his ideas so long as I have the slightest objection to them. In any case, the whole of the winter, we've had no pistol shots. Words have been the only means of attracting attention. Very well, then. My father, a superior man who is carrying the fortunes of our house ever higher, respects Julian. All the rest hate him, but nobody despises him, save my mother's pious friends. The Comte de Calus had or pretended to have a great passion for horses. He spent his life in the stables and would often dine there. This great passion, together with the habit of never indulging in laughter, made him much respected among his friends. He was the eagle of the little group. As soon as they were assembled behind Madame de la Mole's sofa, the following evening, Julian not being present, Monsieur de Calus, supported by Cresnoy and Norbert, sharply attacked Matilda's high estimation of Julian, and this without provocation, almost as soon as he saw Mademoiselle de la Mole. She saw through this manoeuvre from a mile off, and it pleased her. These people are all in league, she said to herself, against a man of talent who hasn't 10 louis in income and is unable to answer them unless he is asked a question. They are scared of him even under his black coat. What would it be like if he were wearing epaulets? She had never been so brilliant. From the very first skirmishes, she overwhelmed Calus and his allies with pleasant sarcasms. When the fire of sallies from these glamorous officers had been dampened, if tomorrow, she said to Monsieur de Calus, some rustic lord from the mountains of the Franche Comte realizes that Julian was his natural son and gave him a name and a few thousand francs, in 6 weeks he would have mustaches like you, gentlemen. In 6 months he would be an officer of the Hussars like you, gentlemen. Then the greatness of his character would no longer be a matter for ridicule. I see you are being reduced, Monsieur the future Duke, to the hoary and mistaken old arguments about the superiority of the court nobility over that of the provinces. But where would you be if I were to push that point to its conclusion? If I was malicious enough to give Julian a Spanish duke for a father, a prisoner of war at Bezicon in Napoleon's time, who, through a scruple of conscience, recognized him on his deathbed. All these suppositions about illegitimate birth were found to be in rather poor taste by Monsieurs de Calus and Cresnoy. That was all they saw in Matilda's argument. However much Norbert was used to being ruled by his sister, she had spoken out so openly that he now assumed an air of severity that fitted rather ill. It must be said, with his kindly and pleasant countenance, he ventured to say a few words. "Are you unwell, my dear?" replied Matilda, with a serious little air. "You must be in rather a poor way to answer banter with morality. Moralizing from you, are you looking for a post as a prefect?" Soon Matilda forgot all about the Comte de Caylus's air of irritation, Norbert's ill humour, and Monsieur de Cruzenot's silent despair, for she must deal with a dreadful notion that came to fasten on her mind. "Julian is sincere enough with me," she said to herself, "at his age, being so low in fortune, made miserable as he is by the astonishing ambition a man needs a woman friend. I perhaps am that friend, but I see no love in him. With his bold temperament, he would have spoken to me of any love." This uncertainty, this internal debate, which from then on took up Matilda's every moment, and concerning which she found new arguments each time Julian spoke to her, entirely chased away those fits of boredom to which she was so liable. At the convent of the Sacred Heart, as the daughter of a man of intellect who might become a minister and give his clergy back their woodlands, Mademoiselle de la Mole had been the object of most excessive flattery. The harm done by this can never be mended. They had persuaded her that, because of all her advantages of birth, fortune, etc., she ought to be happier than other girls. Such an idea is the source of the ennui of princes and all their follies. Matilda had not escaped from its baneful influence. However much intelligence one has, at 10 years old one cannot be one's guard against a convent full of flatteries, especially ones that are apparently well founded. From the moment she decided that she loved Julian, she was no longer bored. Every day she would congratulate herself on her decision to allow herself a grand passion. Such an amusement has many dangers, thought she. So much the better. 1,000 times better. Without a grand passion, I was dying of boredom at the finest time of my life, from 16 to 20. I have already wasted my best years, obliged to derive my only pleasures from listening to the chatter of my mother's friends, who, I gather, were not entirely as strict as Coblins in 1792 as their words would suggest today. It was while these looming uncertainties preoccupied Matilda that Julian was unable to interpret the long gazes she cast upon him. He registered clearly enough, though, the great increase of coldness in Comte Norbert's manners and the fresh outbursts of haughtiness in those Monsieurs de Caylus, Luz, and Cresnoir. He was used to these. Sometimes such unpleasant experiences would occur at the end of an evening when he had shone with more brilliance than befitted his station, if it hadn't been for the marked welcome extended to him by Matilda and the curiosity the whole set inspired in him, he would have avoided accompanying those glamorous mustachioed young men who then attend Mademoiselle de la Mole into the garden after dinner. "Yes, I cannot possibly pretend to myself," thought Julian, "that Mademoiselle de la Mole doesn't gaze at me in a strange way. Yet, even when those beautiful blue eyes which follow me are opened wide in the least guarded fashion, I always see a critical element in their depths, an element of detachment and mischievousness. Can this possibly be love? What a contrast to the gaze of Madame de Renal." One evening after dinner, Julian, who had gone to Madame de la Mole into his office, was quickly returning to the garden. As, without thinking about it, he approached Matilda's group, he overheard a few words ring out quite loud. She was teasing her brother. Julian heard his own name pronounced twice. He came into view. A profound silence suddenly descended, and efforts to break it were useless. Madame de la Mole and her brother were too heated to find another topic of conversation. Monsieurs de Caylus, de Cruzenoy, and Luz and their friends seemed to Julian to have turned to ice. He took himself off. All right, there we go. There's chapter 12. Have your say on the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.